Welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Students return to Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School today in Florida, their first time back after 17 were killed in a mass shooting 2 weeks ago. The Parkland shooting has seemed to galvanize students, citizens, corporations, and politicians into action. Something must be done to make our schools safer, most everyone agrees. But just what that something should be, of course, is as polarizing as the long American gun debate itself. Let's see how two top Michigan teachers feel about school safety. Matinga Ragatz taught high school in Grand Ledge. She was named Michigan Teacher of the Year in 2011, and in 2017, she was inducted into the National Teachers Hall of Fame. Matinga, welcome.
Thank you so much, Cynthia.
And Rick Joseph was Michigan Teacher of the Year in 2016. He teaches grades 5 and 6 at Birmingham Public Schools in Oakland County. Rick, welcome.
Thank you, Cynthia.
So glad to have you both here. So let's start out with this basic idea that let teachers volunteer to carry a gun on the job, undergo special training, maybe get a bonus for volunteering. Matinga, what do you think of that?
Well, I personally believe that that conversation needs to be outside of the school. Like, we need to keep the politics outside of the school doors, because if we can stop with the finger pointing and we can stop with the binary thinking, we will have a minute to think about the logistics of what is proposed. Because in my sense, you know, you're paying teachers extra for carrying a gun. So there are teachers in the building who have done the education, they have the degrees, they have the expertise, but now then they cannot get a raise. They have maybe a 0.5% raise all in 5 years, but suddenly if I go get a gun, suddenly I can get a raise. So there's a lot of logistics. I've spoken to school administrators, and I can tell you this much, any school administrator that is listening to me right now can understand, oh my gosh, there's a new initiative coming up, and all of the logistics and all the pressure points that logistics needs to be addressed. And so I think the debate needs to be out of the school so that we can concentrate specifically on the logistics of even considering having guns in the classrooms.
Rick Joseph, your thoughts.
I'm fundamentally opposed to having teachers carry guns. I think that a teacher's primary mission is to educate students, and possessing a gun or having a gun on school premises is fundamentally opposed to what schools are and why they exist. I think, you know, as Matinga alluded, the resources really ought to be focused more on helping schools do what schools do best, which is educate children.
Do you know any teachers who would carry a gun? Has that been talked about as you all kind of, you know, are in the coffee break room? I mean, what do other teachers say?
I did an informal poll of my team, and I work on a team of 8 teachers at my school, and I spoke with a colleague who said, we need to have a fighting chance. This is a colleague who would be comfortable having firearms training and felt like, you know, I would carry a handgun in an ankle holster. Nobody would know that I had it, but at least if an intruder broke into the school, if it was an active shooter situation, I at least would have a fighting chance. So I would be able to shoot back at them as opposed to only being armed with a stapler. But this person's view was in the minority. The other colleagues on my team felt that even the notion of having guns was almost unfathomable. Plus, it's fraught with all kinds of issues. The reality is, once we're in an active shooter situation, it's completely unpredictable. No one knows how anyone would react, and the potential harm of having guns in school on a daily basis far outweighs the potential of ever even having an active shooter situation, which still remains relatively low.
I do think that we're at a point of recognition. There's pretty widespread agreement. We have to do something. So what do you think we should do? How can we make schools safer in your view? Matinga, I'll let you start.
Well, I think that instead of investing in guns, because, you know, again, who's going to pay for these guns? Who's going to maintain them? Are they going to take away from the arts to be able to purchase the guns? If we're going to invest in education, and we are really indeed talking about real mental health, why don't we reinvest in the health and wellness of the whole child by bringing back the school psychologists and bringing back the medical staff into the school? Right now, we do have social workers who take care of crisis and intervention, or they take care of the children when they are post the trauma. but we have very little preventative mental health for the children. So if we're going to indeed take care of mental health, bring back the resources so a child can be like, you know what, I need to talk to somebody, and I need to talk to, and within a week they should be able to have an appointment where they can talk to a mental health professional about something they're going through. But our extreme focus on results of these scores and assessments is taking away and sucking up basically all of the logic from taking care of the entire child rather than just the scores and the rankings.
Yeah, you make such a point when I think that we used to have school nurses or school psychologists, and that is not the case, who could see things day to day to day and pick up these maybe subtle changes in a child's behavior where a teacher would have someone to send that child to. Rick, what ideas would you have to make our schools safer?
Cynthia, education is a relationships game, and we have to establish good relationships with our students in order to best educate them. And in addition, we need to establish good relationships with parents and families. And together, we all work for the benefit of the kid. And so, as Matinga said, it's important to sort of reinvest in health and wellness programs that support students and create communities of care. We've had, in Birmingham, for example, a cut to our school counseling staff so that elementary schools in our district don't have school counselors. So a lot of the counseling duties fall on the shoulders of administrators who are already, you know, overburdened, if you will. And so resources are already extraordinarily scarce, but anything we can do to enhance the quality of the relationships that we form with our students so that we can know who they are and we can spot any potential distress that a student might be in so that we can act on red flags that pop up in short order. That, I think, goes much farther over the long term than enabling teachers to carry guns in schools.
So we hear these ideas, guys. We hear, you know, more mental health services, the idea of let's get psychologists and nurses back in schools, stricter background checks, metal detectors at school doors, raising the age at which you can buy a gun, banning assault rifles. All these ideas are flying around, but we still are not certain the steps would work, and they would take time to enact and implement. And in the meantime, you get these high-powered weapons like the AR-15 out there by the tens of thousands, and they aren't going anywhere anytime soon. So this is the world we're living in. So how do we better protect schools right now from someone ready to kill, like we've seen at Columbine and Sandy Hook, Parkland, and other schools?
That is something a teacher I can't do, just like the police officers at the scene couldn't do either. We can't try to stop a tsunami with a finger. However, we can put things in place that are going to be preventative. So, teachers, us as politically involved as we want to be, we cannot affect the gun conversation that is going on right now. But something that the lawmakers could do, if they don't want to address this issue, is possibly lessen their obsession with specific curriculum standards, specific content, and so that the teacher can have much more time to be more holistic in their practice. So right now, we have so many little details that we have to, like, it's such a big checklist of things that we have to do as teachers that it's very difficult to stop and look at a child's eye and go, something's not right. So something that you can do really quickly without necessarily changing laws or changing mindset is just lessening the burden, the academic burden for the child. Because here's the thing, the laws have not changed, but society has changed, so the laws have to kind of get with the time. So I'm not asking people to go back and take their rights away. I'm just saying, if the society is changing, and if it's a thing now that kids can go into a school and shoot their peers, the laws have to keep up with the times. And so while the politicians and the lawmakers are taking care of that, in the meantime, if we could have less burdens on the teacher so we can focus on the whole child, thus preventing incidents like this.
Rick Joseph, how has all of this affected your approach to and your passion for teaching?
All of these school shootings have reminded me, again, of the primal importance of really getting to know my students and knowing them more than just kids who get work done in a classroom. I need to know as much as I can about them and do my best to notice if something might not be right about them, because I want to be able to do everything I can to make sure that child feels as safe and secure as possible in school. So that means I address issues related to peer mistreatment and bullying. And I also am very sensitive to making sure that kids are aware of the importance of being kind and being thoughtful in their words, in their deeds, and in their tone of voice, for example. That being said, as Matinga mentioned, I am also very mindful of the reality that we live in a society where there's 350 million guns, in our country. And so that is a reality. And as you said, Cynthia, those guns aren't going away anytime soon. So we do have measures in place, as do most school districts, to make sure that people are buzzed into the door, for example. And, of course, we have lockdown drills in our school and those sorts of things. And I think that all of those measures have just become more and more, I'm more acutely aware of them, if nothing else, in the wake of each successive shooting. So I do think there has to be a multi-pronged approach. On the one hand, we have to get rid of assault rifles. There's no reason why people should have them. And I also think we need to make sure we have background checks that make sense and that, existing laws on background checks are followed through. While at the same time, teachers are able to do their job as educators, forging those relationships with students and doing our best to make sure that we can spot kids who may need extra support.
Teachers Matinga Rigatz, Rick Joseph, thank you so much. It was great to talk with both of you, and thank you for spending time with us on Stateside.
Thank you so much, Cynthia.
Thanks, Cynthia.
You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Before Black Panther arrived on the scene, the talk of the movie world was the surprise success of Jumanji, Welcome to the Jungle.
I think we've become the avatars we chose.
Welcome to Jumanji.
This is a video game, which means we each have three lives.
Come on, let's go.
I'm Alex.
Watch your step in here.
So gnarly.
It's the second film version of Michigan native Chris Van Allsburg's book, Jumanji, and this is among the top three most successful films in the history of Sony Studios. Van Allsburg, of course, is the renowned writer and illustrator of children's books. He won two Caldecott medals for his illustrations for the Polar Express and for Jumanji, which he published in 1981. Van Allsburg grew up in Grand Rapids. Here's the conversation I had with him just before the film opened last December, before he had any idea that this latest film version of his classic book would turn out to be such a rousing success. So I'm curious, where did you get that original idea for this board game that's magical with real animals and jungle dangers that players face in real life? Where did this idea come to you?
Well, I wrote the story as an adult, but I had recollections of feeling a kind of a disappointment when I played board games when I was a kid. I had decent imagination, but there was still something vaguely disappointing about playing Monopoly and not having real money, that sort of thing. And and so I thought, wouldn't it be interesting if there was such a thing as a board game, which did not require the imagination of the players, because everything that happened on the board game actually came to life, happened in real life. So that was the kind of starting point. And then I thought about different kinds of games, and I sort of hit on a jungle game because I thought the combination of jungle perils inside your house would be a provocative combination.
And now we get to actually ask the creator, where did the word Jumanji come from, and does it mean anything?
Well, it does now. It's the name of a game, but when I was just sort of, casting around for a name, I was set on finding something that was slightly exotic, didn't sound like it was a word from the English language. And I think maybe the J attracted me because it sort of suggested jungle. And I don't know, it just sort of at that point sprang into my head, Jumanji.
There you go. So it came out of your brain. And of course, we all remember the 1995 film version of Jumanji with Robin Williams as Alan Parrish. How involved were you with that production, Chris?
Well, in the development process, I was involved. There is, of course, this story, which is the intellectual property that is the book. And so that's a starting point. But in the short things that I write, obviously a great deal needs to be added. That happens through the development process and screenwriting process. So during that period of development, I was involved in contributing ideas about how the story might be developed. And then at a point, my contributions were, you know, taken away by screenwriters, and they wrote many screenplays and finally ended up with the Jumanji that we know.
And certainly one of Robin Williams' more memorable roles. And now we have this remake. What were your thoughts when you heard that there was a remake in the works?
I think maybe 2 or 3 years after Jumanji, they'd already set about trying to exploit the popularity of the first film with a sequel, which is kind of a financial model for Hollywood. But they struggled for some years getting a script that they liked, that they thought did justice to the first, was worthy of the name Jumanji. And in the meantime, I was working on a book sequel to the Jumanji book that I wrote. Because on the last page of the book, Jumanji, there are two children running off with a game.
Yes.
Identified as Danny and Walter Budwing. And so I, as the author of the book and with the rights to write a sequel to that book, decided I would find out what happened to Danny and Walter Budwing and wrote a story called Zathura, which is a space adventure game. And so Sony liked that a lot. They went ahead and made it, and they sort of thought of it as a Jumanji sequel, but not really.
Ah.
So I guess about 3-4 years ago, the studio executives started thinking, you know, we haven't really tapped into the Jumanji enthusiasm that exists out there. Of course, a lot of the audience that saw it back in 95 is old enough now and has they have their own children. Usually sequels don't come out that
much time span, yeah.
That time frame. But so they figure, well, that's great. Now parents will take their kids to see Jumanji 2.
And here we have it, Jumanji. Yeah. Welcome to the Jungle. What do you like about this new version?
It's updated. It's no longer a board game. It's a video game. And I think maybe the most interesting thing about it is the use of a convention in video game design, which is that when people play it, they can choose an avatar. So when they actually play the game, they're playing sort of through the identity of this avatar of a character in the video game. So this is actually what happens to the four teenagers who play this game. They all end up drawn into this video game, but when they arrive in the video game, they do not arrive in their own bodies. They now inhabit their avatars.
And as a matter of fact, I'll tell you, I saw a review in the Wall Street Journal by Joe Morgenstern who said a lot of the fun is in figuring out who winds up as, you know, Dwayne Johnson or who winds up as Jack Black. And even Joe said, I'm not going to tell you, I'm going to leave you the fun of discovering
that. yeah. So the goal, obviously, in using a premise like that would be to make the most extreme contrast you could between the, the individual playing and the avatar they inhabit. But the interesting thing about it is that it's a sort of collaborative effort amongst these four actors, but the four actors actually represent 8 characters because they not only have the character of the avatar, but they also have the character of the person they were before they became the avatar.
Gotta wonder, when you published Jumanji 36 years ago, would you have imagined 2 films, plus that animated TV show from the 90s, plus, as you say, you had the sequel film. Would you have ever thought that was going to happen?
Well, no. I mean, authors fantasize about the impact their efforts might have on a reading audience, or in the case of a picture book, a reading viewing audience. And you want to believe that it will find an audience that will be enthusiastically received. But it would be delusional and to actually believe that, oh, the thing I'm working on now will, you know, generate a couple of films and it'll be around for years and years and years. So, no, I did not entertain those ideas. I am maybe not so surprised because it's happened slowly and gradually in my career, but I certainly feel fortunate.
That is Chris Van Allsburg. We recorded the conversation in December, just before the Michigan premiere of Jumanji, Welcome to the Jungle. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty.
I came home. I showed up. I was involved. I went to all the football games. I was there when he had his first breakup with his girlfriend.
And now a story from Failure Lab. Cole Williams is the founder of the Son to a Father Project, and the Son to a Father Parenting Skills Training Program. It's a series of workshops that explore the journey of fatherhood. Here he is talking about his own father and about being a dad himself.
This has probably been one of the hardest experiences I've ever had in my life. Because for the first time, I've actually had to say out loud that I'm a failure. I've said that often in my head. I've thought about it. I've lived with it for a long, long time. The concept of failing, of never being good enough for people, for myself. I failed. I became a father. It's a powerful word. Often goes missing, invisible. People can't find us, see us, don't even know that we exist. How I have looked for my own father. Let me tell you about him. I remember searching for him in shadows. So many shadows I searched for my father. Oh, the things I would do to get my hands on him, to touch him, to let him feel my heartbeat. Oh, how I wanted my father. My feet would tingle of the thought of my father being present. My heart would beat faster for the thought of my father. But something happened. My father, he never showed up. And I looked for him. Again, I looked for him in shadows because shadows do something so profound if you know anything about shadows. They have the ability to change shapes and objects and angles. They do a lot of things. And so over time, I became a master of geometry because I wanted to find my father. So like many boys across America, or like many girls across America, we look for them. And I couldn't find them. So I found them in other people. It's funny what happens when you start to look for people in other people and realize that other people don't know you. So I got a blessing, something that a lot of people don't get a chance to have when you grow up fatherless. I got a blessing and an opportunity to find my father. See, I didn't know his voice. I didn't know what he looked like, but I knew inside of me he existed. Because again, I looked for him and I heard his voice for the first time. Almost like the sound I'm guessing Moses must have heard in the burning, at the burning bush. Oh, Dad, is that you? I found him. And so my story today is really about this boy inside of me who's yelling and screaming to locate this father. Because again, I said that I'm a father. I became a 16-year-old father. And then I fast-forwarded to becoming an adoptive and foster father. So in 5, 6, 7 years, fast-forwarding from being 16, I became this dad to all of these young people who were searching like me for fathers, for missing people. And it's funny because when people go missing, it's amazing what you do to find them. When I saw my father and met him for the first time, you know what I asked him? I asked him the biggest question that most children ask when parents go missing. Where were you? He gave an answer that was so deep, I've still held on to it. He said to me, son, I didn't even know you were missing. Daddy, how dare you not know that I was missing? And it showed up. Him missing in my life showed up in the way that I parented. See, I do this cool thing now. I get an opportunity to work with parents. And so I get to tell them about this concept that children love you no matter what you do. They love you, right? I love my father. My sons, they love me. But even I went missing. Here I am, I'm not missing. I didn't do what my father did. I came home. I showed up. I was involved. I went to all the football games. I was there when he had his first breakup with his girlfriend. I was there. It's funny that I didn't realize that I really wasn't there. Something happens when we get busy. I went missing right in front of my own children, and I didn't even know it. They missed me when I was absent with my hugs. See, I would hug, but I didn't know how to hug. See, my mother was this amazing woman. She didn't hug. She didn't know how powerful her hug was because nobody had hugged her. And so when it was time to hug me, she couldn't. So when it was time for me to hug them, I didn't know how. So when I hugged them, I did like this. Yes, I was scared of the touch. I was absent in my words. I would say, I love you. But did I really? How could I love if I never knew what it felt like? I thought if I had my son, that would be it. That love would just resonate and it would do everything for me. But as a little boy and a grown man, I still longed to be loved. And so I started rescuing myself. I teach inside the Kent County Detention Center here in Grand Rapids. And I get the amazing opportunity to do something that a lot of people don't get a chance to do. I get to see past the labels. And I get to see children who are chasing shadows, who are looking for parents to show up. My son said something to me so profound, and I realized I had failed as a parent when he said to me, he said, "Dad, you know what? You spend more time with those kids than you do with me." I heard something one day. It said, "I wish that I could hire my mother and my father. If I hired them, then they would spend more time with me." Oh my gosh, what? All this time I thought the routine was I go get a job, I get this career, I make a living for us. That's how I show you that I love you. That's how I show you that I care. I had no idea that caring started with simply being present. I failed at being present. I didn't know, as a father, as a parent, that the best gift I walked around with was me. I thought it was something I had to purchase during Christmas. Isn't that what they tell you? I had no idea that my son simply wanted me to be with him, wanted to be present with me like I wanted with my father. I wanted my father to be present. I wanted him to be the biggest gift that would show up on Christmas. I wanted him to be the biggest gift that would show up in my heart. I had no idea that I was failing as a parent when I realized that I was not teaching my son's grace and mercy. I thought that was God's responsibility. I had no idea that in order for him, in order for them to know what grace and mercy felt like, it first had to come from me. From me. Cole. Broken Cole. He doesn't have grace and mercy in him. I failed at relationships. I probably have some friends in this audience today who could attest to not having full access to me. I'm good at disappearing. It's almost a gift. I let you get real close, but not close enough. Because again, I was missing. And so, what I've learned as a parent, and as a, I guess I could say, where I failed at, is I failed at never giving myself a chance to love, never giving myself a chance to be okay with me, and never giving my father a chance to know that I love him. I love you.
Cole Williams is a motivational speaker, parent, mentor, and community leader in Grand Rapids. His story and others from our partners at Failure Lab can be found at failure-lab.com. Still to come, the Jim Crow Museum at Ferris State University on its newest display, the controversial
blackface photos.
Many of the images that are photographed in the Polaroids are actually objects that we have in the Jim Crow Museum.
Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Well, it's Wednesday, which means it's time to talk our state's history.
I've sent the following wire to President Truman. My heartiest congratulations to you on your election.
I'm aware of my blackness, but I don't go around and look and see whether I'm different than someone else.
Fail a lot quickly, and then eventually you'll succeed.
I worry that the person who thought up Muzak may be thinking up something else.
Michigan is known, of course, as an automotive capital. But think about this. With Little Caesars, Domino's, Hungry Howie's, and Jets all headquartered here in Michigan, you can make a pretty strong case our state is also a pizza capital, to the point where, as far as we know, Michigan is the only state to have had a pizza funeral. Here to tell us about the great pizza funeral of 1973 is Mark Harvey, the state archivist with the Michigan History Center. Okay, Mark, the idea of a pizza funeral, it sounds more like an Onion headline than reality. Where does this all start?
Well, Cynthia, interestingly, it starts in Ohio, that darn state that keeps cropping up. There is a company in Ohio called United Canning, and they noticed an abnormal number of cans swelling in its inventory. They had recently automated their packing process, going from hand packing these cans of mushrooms to machine packing them, and it overfilled them, and they weren't sterilized like they should have been, and they had them tested by the FDA, and tests came back and confirmed that botulism was present in the can. So then the FDA turned and contacted their wholesaler, Tolona Pizza Products from Chicago, and then Tolona started calling all of its customers on February 19th, 1973.
So one of the people who used these mushrooms was a man named Mario Fabbrini, owner of Papa Fabbrini's Frozen Pizzas. Tell us a little about him. True immigrant story, isn't it?
True immigrant story. He immigrated from Italy post-World War II, said he was, in an interview, he was really caught up in fascist Italy and they were just trying to get out. So the war ended, the family immigrated to Michigan, and from there it really follows that stereotypical American success story, building a small pizzeria. He was quoted as saying that Americans wouldn't touch the pizza that they made in Italy, so they had to change things up a bit, but then they built this family business into a fairly big frozen pizza distribution company in Ossining, Michigan, near Alpena.
And how did he react when he gets this news about the possible problem with the mushrooms?
Not surprisingly, he was just crushed when he got the call about the mushrooms, knowing that this was really bad for business. They immediately stopped their shipments. They recalled any pizzas that they could that had been already shipped out. But he knew this was not good.
Do we know if anyone actually got sick from eating his pizzas?
So they did some initial testing, and it's really unclear from the reports I've read and the court case transcripts who did the initial test with some mice. So it was either Mario or the FDA lab. Those tests came back initially positive because the mice had died. As word got out, this became front page news around the state. All of a sudden, some people started showing up saying, "Hey, I got sick from eating your pizza." I think at the time they didn't know if this was just people looking for a payout on a court case or if they were actually sick.
Well, then here we have this owner of Papa Fabbrini's Frozen Pizzas. Mario has to make the best of this awful situation with these, some 30,000 pizzas that are suspects. So tell us about this solution of his.
The pizza funeral concept was probably one part showmanship and one part show of accountability. Really, for Mario, it was that Hail Mary pass to try to save his business. He could see the ship was going down. And maybe by creating a public spectacle, the hope was to get some good press and let the public know that here is a self-made person trying to do right. They caught it.
So take us to the funeral. What was it like and what happened and who was there?
Well, they brought all the pizzas in a dump truck. You know, there's lots of different reports, anywhere up to 40,000 pizzas. The actual court transcript listed at 29,188. Thank you very much.
Oh, well.
And they dump them into this landfill, wrapper and all. There's at least two different newspaper accounts that report that Governor Milliken was present and gave the homily and talked about courage in the face of tragedy.
Now, this is an interesting twist. Here you have Governor Milliken eulogizing Papa Fabbrini's possibly tainted pizzas. What do you think was the political point he was making?
So I did a search of Milliken's records trying to find an actual transcript of this,
this
or even
eulogy.
A press release. Yeah. It was suspiciously absent. So I don't know if it was because he was a proponent of small business or he's just trying to be part of this spectacle to lessen public fear of the botulism outbreak. It's not 100% clear.
And so while the great pizza funeral of 1973 is happening in Osinek up near Alpena, what was going on with testing these tainted mushrooms? What were the ultimate results?
So the lab mice initially had died, and they just assumed it was botulism. But when the actual test came back, it was determined by the FDA and later testified in court by the state veterinarian that it was not botulism. It was an unrelated case of peritonitis, which it's very similar to botulism in that it's caused by bacteria. It's an inflammation of the lining of the stomach. So you could see why it may have been misdiagnosed, but it wasn't botulism.
And Fabbrini had a pretty good crack, didn't he? He told reporters.
Yeah, he was quoted as saying, well, maybe the mice didn't like my pizza and therefore they died.
What ultimately happened to Mario Fabbrini and to his company?
So Fabbrini wound up taking a few companies to court that were involved in the mechanization of the packing of the mushrooms and the distribution company, and this dragged on. So the funeral was in March of 73. The court case was finally settled in the Michigan Appeals Court in 1979, and Fabbrini was ultimately awarded $211,000. But after that many years of legal bills, it still left him with very little, and he sold the business assets in the early 1980s and just had to walk away from it.
Huh. We have a fascinating story of the great pizza funeral of Michigan, which happened 45 years ago, March 5th, 1973. State Archivist at the Michigan History Center, Mark Harvey, always great digging up these nuggets of Michigan history with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Support for arts and culture coverage comes in part from the Michigan Council for Arts and Cultural Affairs. Ferris State University's Jim Crow Museum of Racist Memorabilia has an important mission: to use objects of intolerance to teach tolerance and promote social justice. The museum recently got a significant donation to help it towards that mission. An anonymous donor has given them 135 Polaroid prints from photographer David Leventhal's famous and controversial blackface series, value some $2 million. David Pilgrim is founder and curator of the Jim Crow Museum of Racist Memorabilia. He is with us now via Skype. David, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
So tell us about these photographs. What was it that David Leventhal photographed for this blackface series?
We probably shouldn't use the word prints. In actuality, what we received were probably half the collection or one of a kind. They are almost poster-sized Polaroids. It made sense for them to donate this collection to us because many of the images in the Polaroids are actually objects that we have in the Jim Crow Museum. The Jim Crow Museum is the largest publicly accessible collection of racist objects in the U.S. I dread to say how many pieces we have because we are receiving objects each day. I think last year we received about 600 objects, but we certainly display in excess of 10,000 objects, and we probably have another 5,000. People come there to have intelligent discussions about race, race relations, and racism. We are not a shrine to racism. What we are instead is something of a museum as laboratory or learning lab. I know it sounds corny, but we believe in the triumph of dialogue, and that's exactly what we're doing in the facility.
When we see these Polaroids, these large Polaroids from David Leventhal, what are they showing us?
Well, they're showing toys, games, banks, you know, small objects. And it's really amazing. And I don't like using the word amazing, and I just did it. But what he has done is found a way to capture these images in a way that almost makes them look like they were real people. The quality of the pieces are, you know, top flight, top drawer. But our purposes are less about the greatness of the art and more about what it is that's being photographed. And so if you think of the everyday objects that people had, and quite frankly, some people still have in their homes, you know, salt and pepper shakers, as I said before, toys and games. He brings his camera in such a way that it gives life to that racist, contemptible object.
These photographs, this blackface series, have been controversial. The Philadelphia Institute of Contemporary Art canceled the exhibition, and Leventhal, in an interview, said he is very aware that these images make people uncomfortable. What do you think Leventhal is saying with these photographs about race and stereotyping?
I think he's, first of all, putting it out in the front of people so that you can't not see it, in much the same way that we do. We, of course, have an advantage over some other facilities. I mean, we actually have racists in our name. As far as I know, we're the only museum in the U.S. that focuses primarily on racist objects. And so we have experience contextualizing both historically and in a contemporary way these objects. Again, they fit neatly into the work that we do. We bring people into the facility. We have them look at an object. And we ask simple questions. What is it you see? What is it you think you see? Why is it you said that? And then we have them listen to others. And of course, we always have a docent present. We are trying to facilitate discussions about race. I think it works. I think these pieces will be great tools in our tool chest.
Is upsetting people, making people in a state of discomfort, David Pilgrim, is that part of the process of teaching tolerance and getting people to think in new ways about social justice?
It was in the 1960s and 1970s. That, quite frankly, is not our objective. While it is the case that people bring their own experiences with race into the facility, and there are people farther along than others on this racial journey, if you would. So you can't be a completely academic facility. But our goal is to present the material in a way that is sound in terms of scholarship. So it is much like if you were to have hundreds of history books about race relations and you took the images that are in those books and put them in one place. The difference with us is we have the objects that are in those images. We are not trying to provoke people in some tantalizing way. We truly won't. And again, I feel like I'm sounding kind of mawkish or corny or trite, but we really want to engage visitors in discussions. Now, again, I have an advantage, which is I have seen this work. We've been doing this work since the mid-1990s at Ferris State University. We moved into a larger facility where we are now in April of 2012. We've had thousands of people come in. We've had people like Malak Shabazz, the daughter of Malcolm X. We've had Henry Louis Gates. We've had Henry Rollins. But we've also had just Americans, people like you and I, who just want to learn. And I've seen it work. So for me, when I talk about our approach, it's not really so much an abstraction, because I've been a part of literally hundreds, if not thousands, of conversations where people engaged the material.
I'm curious, you say you are getting objects added to the collection all the time. So what is the most recent piece you have in the museum?
Let's see, someone just sent in a door stand, sort of like the dumb waiters. Mm-hmm. You know, the inanimate objects that people would put in the front of their house, and it's about 3 feet tall. It welcomes the person into their home. So someone sent that. And we recently got a collection of 30 or 40 pieces that were primarily ashtrays.
Are there things still being produced? Something contemporaneous where you could say, my gosh, that was just made?
I believe the U.S. has made considerable progress in terms of becoming a more democratic and egalitarian society. However, I believe that there are no images slash objects in our museum that are not currently being made. Some of them are being made as fake antiques. Some of them are images and objects that have morphed from the past to the present. So in the museum, despite our name, we actually have a section which we call contemporary objects. There's a whole section on racist portrayals of President Obama. And that would be an example. So yes, if there's a race-based incident that occurs, which receives significant national attention, there will be a two or three-dimensional object created within 1 week. And again, that's not a hypothesis. That's me having done this work for more than 20 years.
David Pilgrim, if you're curating this museum, let's say 20 years from now, what do you think from our era, 2018, as we speak, what would go into the Jim Crow Museum of Racist Memorabilia?
Well, one of the fortunate things we did was we did not stop collecting objects. So you think because of our name, we'd only have things from the Jim Crow era, 1870s to the 1960s. However, we collect modern pieces. So as I was saying, if there are racial incidents, which I have no reason to suspect that we won't have some, whatever they are. I have to tell you, though, there has been a sort of spike in racial objects that have come to our attention over the last 16 months. I don't think you have to be a sociologist to understand that there's a kind of racial rhetoric which exists today and is being broadcast today that is reminiscent of the 1960s and 70s when I was growing up under George Wallace in Alabama. So I think those objects will be reflected. But I have to tell you, the first thing I thought when you said the question was, I hope I'm still around 20 years from now. So,
of course. So what might be one of these objects that to you says, yeah, that was 2017, 2018? Give me a for instance of one of these objects.
It would be probably something in the political realm, because those are objects that show, like in the case of former President Obama, when he's being portrayed as a monkey or a witch doctor or, you know, Tom caricature, I will always associate the defaming of him with this period. Having said that, I can't think of a politician with whom I agree. And yet, one of the things that I say to people in the museum is, just because we disagree with someone does not mean we have to reduce them to racial caricatures. The museum also has small sections which deal with African-American response to racist imagery. And so we have a section on African-American achievers and African-American thinkers and artists who use their art to deconstruct racism. That's not primarily who we are, but that's an important part of the story. And my favorite piece is an ink pen that President Johnson used to sign the 1964 Civil Rights Act into law. And I have that piece. And so we also collect that material. And it's not a good segue, but I also want to add that, you know, we also in the early stages of building a sexism museum, because I believe Dr. King, when he said injustice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere.
The Jim Crow Museum of Racist Memorabilia, the mission, use objects of intolerance to teach tolerance and promote social justice at the campus of Ferris State University. And you can find out more information about the museum by going to ferris.edu. David Pilgrim, it is a pleasure to talk with you. Thank you so very much.
Thank you. Have a good day.
And that's Stateside for today. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so very much for listening.